Kia ora, hello, and welcome to this Webber Training Teleclass Lecture, which is the first of the South Pacific series, well, for 2012 anyway. My name is Jane Barnett, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce today's speaker, who will be known to many of us that work here in New Zealand, Dr. Nikki Turner. Nikki works as the Director of the Immunisation Advisory Centre, IMAC, is a senior lecturer in the Division of General Practice and Primary Healthcare, as well as also being a practicing general practitioner. She specialises in immunisation and preventive child health issues and currently works from Wellington, based in the University School of Medicine in Wellington, and as a general practitioner with Newtown Union Health Centre. Nikki represents the Immunisation Advisory Centre and the RNZCGP on a number of New Zealand Ministry Advisory Committees. She is chair of the Immunisation Technical Forum and is an executive member and a health spokesperson for the Child Poverty Action Group. Nikki's main personal interests are in child poverty and preventive child health. Nikki, with that bio, I wonder that you found time to be with us today, but I'm very grateful that you did. So welcome and thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us on the subject of outbreaks of vaccine-preventable diseases, communicating the science and closing the gaps.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for that very warm welcome, and it's a privilege to be here. I always find it a little odd talking to myself for sort of three-quarters of an hour, so forgive me if I sound a little rambling at times, and it's a shame I can't get people's feedback. But in general, I'll talk to everybody from a New Zealand perspective, but I'll try and put it into the context of the bigger perspective, as there are, you know, significant differences across our countries. Now, if hopefully you've all got the presentation up there, and if you go to the second slide, I mean, I always start from this point that whatever we debate within our science around vaccination, what we know is that vaccination has had an extraordinary effect around the world. And so I've got a quote from the World Health Organization there: only clean water and antibiotics have had an impact on childhood death and disease that is equal to that of vaccines. And slide three, I've got a list of diseases that vaccination has significantly impacted upon, and we'll all be aware of the eradication of smallpox in 1977. But you can see there's a long list of diseases, and there's even more than that, that vaccination has made an enormous difference within all our countries and internationally. The next two slides, I've got a picture of polio deaths in New Zealand, which is a very graphic example of the difference that happened to polio when we introduced the oral polio vaccination in New Zealand. This was seen all around the world, and it was one of the most dramatic examples of vaccination program. And slide number five I often show, this is a New Zealand slide of what happened when in 1994 we added the Hib vaccination to New Zealand. Prior to the vaccination, Haemophilus influenza was the most common cause of bacterial pneumonia. Bacterial meningitis, I apologise, in children under five. And this has had a dramatic impact. And even though this is a rather boring-looking graph, you know, what it really shows is we are seeing somewhere between 20 to 50 children less a year in New Zealand with Hib meningitis and all the other complications of Hib, epiglottitis, and the diseases that we practically never see now. So those are a couple of graphic examples of the effect of vaccination. I think we always need to start from that context as to why internationally and locally we put so much emphasis on vaccination programs. Now, moving on to the sixth slide, this is what I'm just going to briefly cover. I'm going to talk about disease outbreaks currently in the New Zealand context, focusing on measles, pertussis, and meningococcal. I'm going to talk about immunisation coverage and the equity that gaps within the New Zealand context, because I think we've had a lot of learnings that we can share about that. And then we've had a lot of experience with the challenges around communicating the science. And I'm going to touch on the occupational health vaccines and other private market vaccines in New Zealand. So if you move to slide seven, and then straight on to slide eight, this is a current graph of the outbreak of measles in New Zealand. Now, I mean, clearly what we know is that if New Zealand had had consistently high enough immunisation coverage, we would not see measles. And many countries around the world have fully eradicated measles with decent immunisation programs. However, New Zealand continues to have outbreaks of measles, which is a reflection of our current, our historical low immunisation coverage. So even though New Zealand's immunisation coverage now has picked up, historically we have had traditionally quite low coverage. So we have got patches all around the country, groups of people with low immunity, where measles can then build up and break out. And what we've seen last year and in the early part of this year is further measles, which sort of a Western country should never see. In fact, no country in the world needs to see measles with an effective immunisation program. And if you look at slide 9, you can see the outbreak of measles last year and how you get this clustering effect. And moving on to slide 10, the age groups that it impacts. Obviously, measles has a significant impact, particularly on children under one who are too young to be vaccinated. And often if their parents have been vaccinated, the children don't necessarily have strong immunity from measles. But what you can see is we're getting measles across many of the age groups in New Zealand, but you'll note that there's very little measles in the older age group. Now, New Zealand, like many other countries, prior to introducing a vaccination program, pretty well every person in the country would have been in contact with measles. So most people around the world, older people, would have had contact with measles, and so you do not tend to see measles in the very older age group. New Zealand introduced a measles vaccination program in 1969, so that for those who had missed their measles vaccination, born since 1969, those are the people at risk. And you can see that there is a risk right across the population.
Okay, well, looking at slide 11, measles control, the major message for how to control measles is obviously, firstly, for anybody in a community who has already been exposed to wild measles when they're young, they are likely to be protected. Now, in New Zealand, we make the assumption that anybody born prior to 1969, because after that time, New Zealand introduced its measles vaccination program. People prior to vaccination program, pretty well 100% of the community was always exposed to measles. So the message in any country is you need to look at where your gaps in immunity are. In New Zealand, we assume they will be from anybody born since 1969 who may have missed out on a measles-containing vaccine. The importance of giving people measles-containing vaccines is the first dose you have at least 90% of people seroconverting to. But if you actually deliver a second dose, you're getting up nearly as high as 98-99% of people who will seroconvert. So a two-dose strategy is much more important, is much more beneficial than a single-dose strategy. In New Zealand, we now recommend two doses for all children born over 12 months of age. Giving vaccination to children under 12 months of age is possible, but sometimes you do get interference from maternal antibodies. Mother, if she has antibody protection, she will pass some of that on to the fetus while she is pregnant, and that will interfere with the MMR. So if you give MMR or measles-containing vaccines to children under 12 months of age, it may interfere with it, hence the importance of giving it to children over 12 months. In New Zealand, we are recommending two doses for all children over 12 months. If any unknown vaccination history or in doubt, revaccinate. There are no concerns about giving too many doses of MMR. When you give MMR, if the body already has immune protection to those three viruses, they will just deactivate the vaccine, so you're very unlikely to get side effects. So it's perfectly safe to over-vaccinate rather than under-vaccinate. Now, moving on from measles, we talk about meningococcal disease. Meningococcal disease is a completely different beast from measles. It's much more problematic to control. There are a range of vaccination strategies that help, but there is no single vaccination strategy that will eradicate all meningococcal disease from the world. So it's a completely different strategy. The first problem is there are many different capsular groups, and six in particular are associated with invasive disease, A, B, C, Y, W13Y, and X. W135 and X. These are variable around the world. Different countries tend to see different groups being more prominent. They all differ by the exterior polysaccharide capsule. In New Zealand, currently, the major types are type B and type C. Meningococcal disease is with us in the community all the time. It's carried in the nasopharynx, particularly of teenagers, and at times you do get outbreaks. Slide 13 shows you the picture of current meningococcal disease distribution around the world, and what you can see is different types of distribution in different parts of the world. Hence, in vaccination strategies, what you suggest to vaccinate to protect your own population can often be quite different from a vaccination strategy for a traveller. You'll notice from this picture that particularly in Central Africa, there is a significant amount of particularly A, but also W13Y, C and X, so that just using a meningococcal C vaccine will not be effective for a traveller to Central Africa, particularly those, and North Africa as well, particularly those who are going on the Hajj, the pilgrims, they will need broader protection. So moving on to slide 40, This is just to 14. This is just to highlight that meningococcal disease is carried in the nasopharynx. You can either carry it just for a few weeks or for months. You can just walk around carrying the bug in your throat and never get sick, and usually your immune system will respond and give you protection. However, and occasionally, it gets through the nasopharynx and invades into the bloodstream and causes disease. The importance of carriage is that meningococcal disease is different from other bacterial diseases in that the carriage rate is particularly high in adolescents. In studies, up to a third, if not more, of adolescents may be carrying meningococcal disease, and it's much lower in the younger children. And it's there in the older age groups, but at a much lower rate. That also reflects the prevalence of this disease, that you see it particularly nasty in the young infants and in teenagers and young adults. Carriage rate is higher when people cluster together and are in close proximity with each other, as you tend to see with crowded housing or people in more confined places, such as students that are going to hostels or in military situations or in prisoners and such like. Meningococcal disease does only live in the human host, and it's important to recognise. Moving on to slide 15, so why does it just sit in the nasopharynx for some people, and then why occasionally does it then go on and cause nasty invasive disease? Well, as always, we don't have the full answer to this. There's likely to be a range of reasons why the organism can get through the barrier of the nasopharynx. Clearly, crowded living conditions appear to have some aspect of this. Things that are more likely to get through the barrier are being exposed to cigarette smoke, having poor nutrition, having another recent respiratory infection seems to be quite a strong driver. And there are other inherited genetic conditions that we don't really fully understand. Slide 16 shows you the current distribution of meningococcal disease in New Zealand. You'll note that New Zealand, as many on this conference are aware, had an outbreak of Group B that occurred from about 2001, a significant outbreak of a specific subtype of Group B. In response to that, New Zealand designed a vaccine specifically tailored to that subgroup, which was used in a mass epidemic campaign from 2004-2005. That vaccine is no longer used because the serotype, that particular epidemic is now waning. It is still in the New Zealand community, but nothing like the large amounts it was a few years back. So currently New Zealand now, if you look at the more recent years, has mostly Group B of several serosubtypes and Group C. So those are the predominant types in New Zealand. Strategies for meningococcal vaccinations. This varies from country to country. Many of the Western countries now have introduced on their infant or young childhood schedule meningococcal C conjugate vaccines, such as the UK and Australia. New Zealand is still discussing whether the burden of disease warrants that in New Zealand, so it's currently on the private market. Other countries like the States have introduced a teenager young adult program where they offer a conjugate quadrivalent meningococcal vaccine to teenagers and young adults. In New Zealand currently, on the private market, there are two different sorts of vaccines. The traditional vaccines are called the polysaccharide meningococcal vaccines, which cover four types. You'll notice that there are no current licensed world vaccines to prevent B meningococcal disease. We're all waiting and hoping and looking forward to the time when we'll have an effective vaccine for B. In the meantime, we have the polysaccharides for ACY and W135. These tend to be used for travel vaccination. They are ineffective in the younger children. They have a reasonably short duration of immunity, and you probably can't use them repeatedly because there is a concern about overusing the antibody pool and getting hyporesponsiveness. The newer and probably more effective vaccines overall are the conjugates. In New Zealand currently, there is the conjugate C available. There is very soon to be available a conjugate quadrivalent, which will replace the old-fashioned polysaccharides. In many countries now, the polysaccharides are not used at all, just the conjugate quadrivalents. These are more effective in younger children, and they have very powerful effects on herd immunity because they actually eradicate it from the nasopharynx. So they have much bigger gains than the polysaccharides for community use. So on the whole, we are likely to move towards using conjugates. The B vaccines, as I've said, we are waiting and hoping they'll be along soon. Now, moving on to the other problematic disease in New Zealand currently is pertussis. Pertussis, once again, has a very different epidemiology from meningococcal and measles. New Zealand currently has an outbreak of pertussis. Pertussis appears in every community in recurrent outbreaks. Pertussis lives in the community all the time. Vaccination schedules are unlikely to eradicate pertussis from the community. Probably the major reasons for this is when you have pertussis, you do get immune protection from it, but your immunity wanes and you can get recurrent pertussis throughout your life. And the same with vaccines. If you're vaccinated against pertussis, you do not get lifelong immunity and you can get recurrent pertussis. The major issue with pertussis is it's a significant issue for anyone who catches it. It gives you a nasty cough, lasts several months and drives everybody nuts, but particularly for the younger children, infants under a year of age, young babies, it can have severe consequences. It can cause apneas, it can cause pneumonias and encephalopathies, and they cough and cough and cough and they can actually get intracerebral bleeds. So the major current strategy for pertussis is to focus on protecting the young infants. You'll see from slide 19 that pertussis, the current notification in New Zealand, you see that there is more pertussis in the infants under one. Now, that is more a reflection of our notification procedures. I think the harder we look in the older people, the more we find pertussis. In fact, more and more people are recognising that pertussis is just under-recognised. With people who turn up with a chronic cough, we're seeing more and more in adults and even in the elderly when you start looking for it. So this is more a reflection of the severity of pertussis and the fact that there is actually more in the under ones. Slide 20 goes over the current strategies for pertussis control. Now, the first message is we are unlikely to be able to eradicate pertussis from the whole community. So our major focus of our strategies is to protect the younger children. The key approach is to get the primary immunisation schedule into our young infants on time and not delay. So it's really ethically unacceptable to delay the onset of the immunisation program because it leaves young children at high risk of pertussis. So the importance of getting vaccination into our infants on time is huge. Other strategies are obviously once you've had your primary course, you would expect that your children have some degree of protection. But until they've completed their primary course of three doses, young children are at high risk of pertussis. So we're looking at other strategies for protecting these children. And one way of doing it is immunising the older children who live in the household and are likely to reinfect the infants. This also reduces the burden of the disease for the older children themselves. We can immunise adults, and now we are pushing more and more the fact that we can immunise pregnant women, and they can offer some degree of protection so they will not infect the infant themselves. Cocoon strategies on that list is about once the infant is born, who around the infant may be able to infect them, immunise those people. So you're talking about immunising the parents, maybe the grandparents, maybe any caregiver who is in close contact with that child. And the other important aspect of the strategy is occupational health immunisation. Anyone who is in close contact with high-risk people, particularly young infants, should be immunised. The current adult pertussis-containing vaccines you can have repeatedly every 10 years, and I think it's important and ethically important for adults who are working with young infants, high-risk people, that they should actually have adult pertussis vaccination every 10 years. This is a strategy that I feel has not been pushed enough, and that it's important that we realise that immunising here does offer you self-protection, but is particularly crucial to protect young infants. Anybody working in neonatal units, in particular oncology units, wards with young infants. And also you can think broader about early infant teachers, preschools, creches, people who are likely to be exposed to young infants who as yet are too young to have protection themselves. Now, moving on from there, many countries now have slightly different national immunisation schedules, and so often you'll find we have this dilemma in New Zealand that there are very good vaccines with very good international evidence for their effectiveness, but they are not currently fully subsidised, so often parents are unaware of their importance. Now, if you look at slide 22, in the New Zealand context, we do not have rotavirus, varicella, or meningococcal vaccines on the national immunisation schedule, yet they are available in the private market. So more and more healthcare providers need to be aware that they need to discuss with parents and with people the other vaccines available on the private market that people are entitled to purchase and that can often offer consistent, considerable health gains. I'd particularly highlight the rotavirus vaccine that's available and varicella vaccine and meningococcal, but also on that list, remember that HPV vaccine is now recommended for men, particularly in the American schedules, they recommend it for men. The HPV virus, the HPV vaccine, the quadrivalent one used in New Zealand, Gardasil is likely to have very strong effect against the majority of genital warts. And more than that, the more we look for HPV viruses, the more we are aware that they are implicated in many other cancers than just cervical cancer, that we now know that HPV virus is a causal factor in many of the other anogenital cancers, such as penile, anal, genitourinary, and also some nasopharyngeal and even some lung cancers. So while these cancers are more rare, they're another reason to consider the use of HPV vaccine in men as well. Obviously, you want to use the vaccination prior to the onset of sexual activity. So we're talking here preferably about teenage boys. And there are certain at-risk groups to think about. It's a little hard when you're talking about prevention, but men who have sex with men, guys who are likely to be in higher risk groups for catching and transmitting HPV virus should be considered. I've highlighted the adult pertussis vaccine. The vaccine down there is written as Boosterix, but there are others on the private market, such as Adacil, which is an excellent DTP vaccine as well, and there are others in the international market. Remember the pneumococcal vaccines. New Zealand does a limited high-risk program on pneumococcal vaccines, but there are many people who are at high risk of pneumococcal disease with chronic lung conditions and immunosuppressing conditions that could benefit from the conjugate PCV13 followed up by the PPV23. Slide 23 is particularly for the New Zealand market. These are the current private purchase cost of non-funded vaccines in New Zealand. Now, it's important to be aware that these are prices excluding GST, and these are prices for the provider. So then the provider also has the transport cost of getting the vaccines and then the cost of delivering them to the patient. So the cost to the actual client is likely to be higher than that. Now, moving on, changing our subjects to look at the issue around immunisation coverage, because these may be great vaccines, but vaccines are no use unless you get high immunisation coverage into the population.
Now, I want to move on and touch on a bit of immunisation coverage in New Zealand. And you'll see from slide 25, there's a UNICEF table there showing that New Zealand historically has had very low immunisation coverage compared to other OECD countries. But happily, moving on to slide 26, you'll see that New Zealand's immunisation coverage over the past few years has improved dramatically. And now, currently, we're sitting on around 91-92% fully immunised. And if you rapidly look at slide 27 and 28, looking at ethnic and socioeconomic disparities, historically in New Zealand, we had very large disparities where Māori children in particular were much less likely to get immunised, and children from poor backgrounds were less likely to get immunised. Now, there are still ethnic and socioeconomic disparity gaps, but these are closing rapidly. And so New Zealand is currently doing a lot better in its immunisation coverage. Our aim is to get 95% of children fully immunised by the age of two and to make sure that our children get immunised on time. And so we've got a way to go, but we've made huge progress. So I think in terms of learning, if you look at slide 29, I just wanted to touch on some of the research that I've been involved with myself around immunisation coverage and why we've made a difference. Because I know that different countries have used different strategies. Australia had a great success with a seven-point plan where they used provider and parent incentives. New Zealand has taken a different approach, mainly because we've taken more of a number eight wire budget approach, that we have less funding in our health service to improve immunisation coverage. So we really wanted to look very hard about what were the key aspects that made a difference to immunisation coverage. So we did quite a large research project back in 2007-2008, looking at what made a difference to improving immunisation coverage in children. And if you look at the schematic picture, the determinants of immunisation coverage at the general practice level, this little picture is designed to show you the effects of different things. In New Zealand, pretty well all children are immunised at the general practice level. And what you can see from this little schema is all the different factors at the practice level have the greatest impact on improving immunisation coverage. Now, the factors at the practice level I'll talk about briefly, but they're systems. They're how well does the practice work, how well do the systems work, how well is the practice as a team functioning. The next most important factors improving immunisation coverage, you can see from these little diagrams, the practice nurse, who is the frontline vaccinator in New Zealand, followed by the doctor, the GP, and then interestingly the attitudes of the parents and the knowledge of the parents are also important. But essentially what we've learned in New Zealand, if you have a child, a family enrolled with a practice with a good relationship and a well-functioning practice, you get high immunisation coverage. So to move on to slide 31, Some of the points that make most of the difference to improving immunization coverage are having infants enrolled at birth with the practice. So you establish a relationship, the family are confident, and then you have good relationships, you have effective practice management systems, stable practice teams that are enabled then to do effective pre-call. They know the children, they know the families, and they can have good relationships. And then they take every opportunity to reduce the missed opportunity so that when children come into general practices, they're not missed, but they know they're due for immunizations and they deliver them. The importance for us as providers, now this study's around general practices and practice nurses, but it's for all of us as providers, the importance of both a knowledgeable and a competent provider. I think to have a provider out there that we do come across who is unaware of the evidence base behind immunization and who is negative, has negative attitudes, really reflects on the parent's confidence. So a confident, knowledgeable healthcare provider makes a huge amount of difference to immunization coverage uptake in the country. If you move on to the next slide, you can see that the attitude and knowledge of the parents and caregivers are important. And what is most important is their knowledge, attitudes and confidence when they're pregnant with the baby. So it's in the antenatal period that it's key. If parents are given misinformation, incorrect information, myths and scare tactics when they are pregnant, then they're less likely to get their children immunized. And we've got some very sad tales of the results of that. So the importance particularly of the antenatal time for parents is huge. And finally, as you'll see in slide 32, focusing on the environment, what New Zealand has learnt over the last few years is it's not just about getting their general practice, the providers, systems right. They're the major focus, but the other focus is then the general community confidence in the science. And us being able to talk about the science confidently and knowledgeably with all its limitations, but with also our confidence. And that goes out to the community. And I think New Zealand now, in our media, is much more confident and has a better trusting relationship with the science than we did 6 or 7 years ago. And so I think it's all about our communication approaches, fitting them to the audience, knowing what people want to know, and being very open and trying to explain our science. So summing all this up in slide 33 is, why is New Zealand improving? Firstly, there have been national targets to focus on immunisation. There are feedback loops both at the district health boards and at the general practice level so that the providers get their data feedback to them, and that's a huge driver for change. So you don't want to be the bottom of the pile. You don't want to be showing up as being the district health board or the practice that's doing the worst. So feedback loops help hugely that we try and improve our approach and engagement at the general practice level, more focus at that level, better systems, and I think us as a confident health sector then spills over to a more confident public. And we are seeing less anti-science nonsense in the media than we have in the past. Obviously, that will always come up, but I think as a country, we're a bit more confident about the effectiveness of our immunisation strategies. Interestingly, the little picture I've showed on slide 45 is a picture of people waiting for polio immunisation in 1962. And I always make this point that, you know, this is consumer demand. People knew what polio was, and boy, did they want the vaccination. And often the problem we have is people aren't always convinced that these diseases are serious. You know, the number of people that still believe that measles is a mild condition or that pertussis doesn't really exist, and until their child or themselves end up unwell or in hospital, they're not convinced about the importance of the vaccine. And yet, interestingly, you know, people will pay large amounts for travel vaccines on the basis that they have sort of nebulous fears about travelling to other countries, and yet within their own country context, they'll be unaware of the high risk. And, you know, and you have very sad examples of children who have ended up very ill with pertussis or measles or some other vaccine-preventable disease, and the parents will have been unaware of how much an issue it is within their own community. And yet I very rarely hit a traveller who doesn't want vaccination. So I think it is all about our risk perception. Now, just to finish off with coverage, I just touch on for New Zealand, slide 35, who is missing out. Now, like many other countries and all the international data, if you look at slide 36, some of our data, this shows you percentage fully immunised on the y-axis by poverty, New Zealand deprivation. And what you can see is the poorer the community, the less likely they are to be immunised. Obviously, there's many more barriers to getting immunised if you come from a poorer background. You know, I think you're much more, got much more stresses in your life. You're much more aware of acute issues. Preventive health issues like immunisation just get missed out. The importance of this diagram in the New Zealand context is it's not just poor people. It's actually poor Māori. And what we know, if you look at slide 37, is that there's a particular group of very vulnerable children in New Zealand who tend to be Māori children from big urban areas, often from solo parent families, often in large urban centres. So there's an association with these kids with a whole lot of poor health outcomes, and immunisation is just one measure of that. These are the children that we need really aggressive outreach strategies for, to find these children, to offer them all the services we can, because these are the kids missing out. Now, I just want to move on at this point to have a bit more general conversation around the whole issue for us as a community around communicating immunisation and the myths and the fears and why it's such a challenge. So if you look at slide 39, you've got the classic cartoon. You've got the healthcare professional on one side saying you should have had her vaccinated with a sick child, and the mother on the other side saying certainly not, it might have made her sick. So it's this whole risk perception of I'm scared of vaccination, I'm scared at what it'll do to my child, and I'm not scared enough of the disease that it might prevent. Now, interestingly, if you look at slide 40, this is an old cartoon from the UK from 1802, and this is when the original smallpox vaccine was starting to be used. And smallpox vaccination, as many of you will be aware, was based on the discovery that the cowpox virus is very similar to the smallpox virus. And if you vaccinate with cowpox, then you get cross-protection against smallpox. And, of course, interestingly, with the anti-vaccination lobby's been with us for a long time, because in this cartoon, there was a huge fear that if you vaccinated with cowpox vaccine, everybody was going to grow cows. And it's a rather lovely cartoon of lots of horrible cow pictures growing out of people. It's a bit like a sort of anti-genetic engineering cartoon nowadays. And the point of showing this is that anti-vaccination lobby and fear of science have been with us for a long time, and validly, because science does make mistakes. So, but often these fears are based more on myths and misunderstanding than on the original science. And, of course, the cowpox vaccination was never ever capable of growing cows out of people's limbs. Now, moving on with these myths, if you look at slide 41, there have been some really sad graphic international examples that have led to reduction in immunisation coverage. Back in 2004 in northern Nigeria, there was a fear created that the polio vaccine was an American strategy to try and put in the contraceptive to reduce the birth rate. I have no idea where it came from, but I think it was general anti-American fear, as a result of which there was mass refusal to vaccinate with polio. And now that's put one of the international eradication steps for polio backwards, because polio is now back in that part of the world. A different example was the hepatitis B vaccine. When it was introduced to the teenage population in France, there was a cluster of cases of multiple sclerosis. People decided it was caused by the vaccine, and they lost confidence in the hepatitis B vaccine, even though the science since has refuted the hypothesis and there is no link. That lives on in the Francophone countries. Many of us will remember back in the 1980s when we thought the old wholesale pertussis was associated with brain damage, which we have not been able to show since. But however, it led to mass lack of confidence in the pertussis vaccine back in the 1980s and 90s, and you had a huge outbreak of pertussis all around the world. And the most recent example, of course, is MMR and autism in the Anglophone countries, in the English-speaking countries. If you move on to the next slide, this is a picture of Dr. Andrew Wakefield. He was a gastroenterologist in London who published an observational study of 12 children. And in the press conference after the publication, he suggested this was linked with MMR vaccine, even though this was just an observational study of these children. And that story travelled all around the world really rapidly. The science at that stage could not answer whether or whether not the MMR vaccine was related to autism. So it spread around the world. There's a huge amount of fear that MMR vaccine causes autism. Autism tends to come on in the second year of life around the same time the MMR vaccine is given, as a result of which, as you see in slide 44, you saw a dramatic increase in measles in the UK and in many other parts of the world. Now, unfortunately, as often goes, the science was slow to catch up. We have very, very, very good science now that does not show a link with MMR and autism. We have at least 21 large epidemiological studies, a whole range of designs in many parts of the world that do not show a link between autism and MMR. Unfortunately, once the myth gets embedded, it's very hard to shift, and you'll still find all around many of the English-speaking countries a fear that MMR is linked to autism, even though the science shows there's not a link. And this is sad on many levels. Firstly, we've seen a lot of measles come back because of this. Secondly, I think autism is a problematic disease and deserves a lot of research. Most of the research funding in the last few years has been channeled off into proving autism's not linked to MMR instead of focusing on what is going on with autism, and I think that's really sad.
Now, if we move to slide 45, there was a further rather sad issue around the autism in Dr. Andrew Wakefield's story, in that not only did this just turn out to be a hypothesis that was not proven, but furthermore, it was actually very poor science and extremely unethical, and Dr. Andrew Wakefield has been shown very clearly to have been practicing very unethical science. Now, this, in a sense, is a bit of a sideshow. The key issue about MMR and autism was that there was a hypothesis that came up that the scientific community has been able to clearly disprove. However, this is another issue for science to be aware of the importance of rigorous science and ethics and following through our scientific processes closely. And I would just highlight in slide 46 a quote from Sir Peter Medawar, who was a Nobel Prize winner in physiology and medicine in 1969. I cannot give any scientist of any age better advice than that the intensity of the conviction that a hypothesis is true has no bearing on whether it is true or not.
Now, moving along the same vein, I want to talk a bit about the power of the media, because we've done quite a bit of work with the New Zealand media in the last 5-10 years. And of course, one of the challenges is the drivers for the media are very different than the drivers in science or in public health. And I quote from a junior producer in NBC in slide 48, our job is to be interesting. If the story also happens to be true, that's great. Now, a New Zealand example of this, the one that is really sad, and if you look in slide 49, you'll see this is a billboard. Now, this billboard is in the middle of Auckland, our biggest city. It was up in Karangi Happy Road. Now, that's a picture. It's a women's magazine called Life. And on it, you can see that there's a picture of a very gorgeous girl there. And the front page, it says, will Gardasil leave your daughter infertile? Now, it doesn't take much visual imprinting for that to freak the hell out of parents and to say, why would I give my daughter the HPV vaccine if there's any issue at all that she may become infertile? Now, this is based on a complete misunderstanding, or possibly deliberate misunderstanding of the science, where if you inject large doses of one of the products in the vaccine into rat peritoneum, it affects the estrus cycles. Now, the product they're talking about is actually in large amounts in ice cream, and particularly in diet-free ice cream. So it's in very small amounts in the vaccine. It's a complete nonsense story. There is not likely to be any association whatsoever. However, the visual pictorial image like this lives on, and we still get people who think there's an association with the HPV vaccine and infertility based on these sort of stories that just get out there as visual pictures and make us scared as parents. A further example of this was a recent example we had in July last year. One of the New Zealand documentaries called Sunday Program showed a story of a very graphic story of the lives of two young adults who had brain damage when they were very young, and they're now adults. They received the wholesale pertussis vaccination when they were young. Now, when they received the wholesale pertussis vaccination, New Zealand no-fault compensation at the time, if we were not sure whether or not a vaccine caused a problem, we would pay out on the basis of no-fault compensation. So these people appropriately got paid out accident compensation. Now, it's no-fault compensation. It does not mean that the vaccine caused the brain damage. We no longer use the wholesale vaccine, and large studies since have not been able to show a link between the vaccine and the brain damage. However, the story was pitched as if the vaccination directly caused the brain damage. So you can imagine the damage that stories like that do. Sadly, if you look at slide 52, you know, we have very large data. And I give you this example of the United States Vaccine Safety Data Link, which is a study of more than 2 million children, which is unable to show an association between pertussis vaccination and brain damage. Now, we showed that to the producers of this program, and they were not interested in the data. They were not interested in the science. They were interested in graphic pictures of damaged children. So I think that's a very graphic example of how we need to negotiate with the media to fit their needs and to fit the needs of public health. I mean, the final story was presented of a young woman on this story who died 6 months after receiving the HPV vaccine. There is absolutely no biological plausibility of a link between the vaccination and the woman's death at all, and yet the family in their grief are looking and wanting a reason for why their teenage girl suddenly dropped dead. And so this was fun as also if this was a link between the vaccine, which clearly there doesn't seem to be any biological possibility whatsoever. But those stories have a lot of wings, they do a lot of damage, and they're very hard on families with children and people's personal grief. So this is a challenge for us in how to mix the science alongside the needs of the media. So I just wanted to move on quickly to why do we think there's such a problem with vaccinations? And of course, I always like my picture there of the boat sailing over the flat earth. And I think slide 55 sort of sums up one of our biggest problems, is that absence of disease is a lousy product to sell. So the better we do with eradicating the diseases, the less people feel the need for the vaccines. And I give you one example there, that if we got fed up with the measles vaccination and decided to give up vaccinating, on a 10-year cohort of New Zealand children, what would we end up seeing? So this is just an estimate of what would happen if we stopped measles vaccination there. And over 10 years, you'd see that we'd end up with the New Zealand cohort somewhere between 200 and 600 deaths, 600 cases of encephalitis, and probably half of those with permanent brain damage. This is based on Western country data. Obviously, the impact of measles is much higher in developing countries and children who have poor nutritional status. But to try and explain to people and make people live and feel and understand the absence of disease, I think is very challenging. And the graph on page 57 is the example that what happened back in the 1970s when people lost confidence in the pertussis vaccine. You drop off your vaccination rates and, of course, disease rates return. You see enough disease, people get panicked and they start vaccinating again. They start vaccinating, they don't see the disease. They start worrying about vaccine side effects, whether real or imagined. So we have a sort of cyclical problem. So I think it's a challenge for us as communities for people to really understand and feel what disease is like when they don't have personal experience of it. The next challenge for us is coincidence versus causality. And this is, you know, a classic example. This is the doctor speaking during a hearing in America to investigate whether an MMR was related to autism. Regardless of what the research tells us, I know what I saw. Now, this sort of thinking is very difficult because our science, our immunisation programs, all our medical healthcare services need to be based on rigorous science. And, you know, observational data is weak. So if you look at the next slide, you'll see that what a lot of the modern research is doing now is try and look at the background rates of disease. If you have an idea of the background rates of disease, when you introduce a vaccination, you've got a better idea then of whether there's an increase in any disease that could in any way be related to the vaccine, so that, you know, you are likely to see the diseases happening all the time in the community. You want to know if there's likely to be an association or not. I move on quickly to the next big challenge, is the misunderstanding of safety surveillance. In New Zealand, we only do what's called passive safety surveillance. In New Zealand, when somebody gets vaccinated, if a problem happens after the vaccine and the family is concerned enough or the healthcare provider is concerned enough, it gets reported to the Centre for Adverse Reaction Monitoring. Now, the purpose of this is not to collect all adverse reactions. The purpose of this is to look for anything that people are unaware of or unexpected. This is not looking at all the adverse reactions, and it is not assigning causality. So the adverse reaction data, such as it is, does not mean the vaccine caused it. So all the cot death reports that happen straight after vaccines or any severe injury or accident that gets reported doesn't mean it's caused by the vaccine. It means we need to consider it. To look for causality, we need to look much harder and you need more than passive data. New Zealand numbers are too small. We rely on the big databases like we did with autism and MMR, like we did to show there's no association with cot death, there's no association with asthma, there's no association with a range of autoimmune diseases. We rely on very big databases, data linking to look at vaccinated versus unvaccinated, to look at changes in diseases over time, and to look at a range of much more rigorous methodology to see are there likely to be any relationships or not. So in slide 61, I listed some examples of long-term vaccine follow-up, and on slide 62, examples of safety evaluation. And I think the example I gave you earlier of the American data on 2 million children looking at the incidence of encephalopathy post-vaccination is very sound data. So we now have a large amount of data and a whole lot of different ways of methodology looking at, if you come up with a hypothesis that the world hasn't checked out, how do you check it out really rapidly? So if somebody comes up with a new disease and thinks it might be related to a vaccine, then go away and look at it. And particularly if you think it's something very rare, because if it was something common, it'll be picked up in the original randomized controlled trials that are designed to check out the vaccine safely. So mostly randomized controlled trials on vaccines are done. You'll know within 1 in 10,000, usually 1 in 100,000, that a vaccine's safe. But if you get something very rare, like 1 in a million, they won't pick it up. So that's where we rely on these big cohort studies. Now, I think most people will be amazed nowadays at how much data we have around most of the common concerns in vaccines, that we can say, yep, there's no relationship between vaccines and diabetes. There's no relationship with multiple sclerosis. There is actually a slight protective effect with COT death, that if you're vaccinated, you're slightly less likely to have COT death, probably because you're less likely to have pertussis. So, you know, we know a great deal now about relationships, and many people are unaware of this. And I just point to slide 63, where what we're relying on in science is not just opinion or editorial or case reports or case theories or even case control, but we're looking for rigorous science. No one study answers all our questions. We need to look at science in many different ways. So we've come a long way. The early vaccines certainly were a bit more rough and ready. The science behind them didn't have the tight checks that they have nowadays. In the early days, there were some errors. There were contaminations of some vaccines way back. We've come a very long way since then, and our safety surveillance is important and must be maintained. If you're going to vaccinate an entire well population, then you need to be very sure you know what you're doing. And it's interesting that as we go over the years and years, and more of the myths that are coming up nowadays are already ones that the science has checked out. So, you know, it's becoming more and more comforting that actually the science has thought about most of these myths. We've checked them out and we cannot find an association. Moving on to a couple of the other challenges. There is the lack of understanding of immunology. We often get a baby's too young, their immune system's overloaded, it gets skewered, there are too many antigens. None of this makes any sense from basic immunology. And if you look at slide 65, one very nice example is that when a baby's born, they are exposed to so many different antigens, your genital tract flora, your fecal flora, breast milk. We have a huge amount of responses to foreign bodies. The moment a baby's born, they're exposed to foreign bodies all over the place. Giving a vaccination is a drop in the ocean, the infant's immune system ability to respond. So if you move on, we'll move past Willie and his fake belt, and you look at the other interesting slide about multiple vaccines. Not only has an infant immune system got more than enough capacity to respond, but the modern antigens are much more purified. So like when we used the old wholesale pertussis vaccine back in 1960 and smallpox, there were like over 3,000 antigens in each vaccine, whereas nowadays you're down to about 50. So not only have we got good science, we've got a lot of safety data, there's also much purified vaccines, much less antigens in them. So the chance of an infant immune system getting overwhelmed is zero. We've got much more capacity. I give you some more. Moving on to slide 69. I think the other challenge is that we have zero tolerance for risk for some things, and other things we take risk quite happily. And I always find it interesting that we'll happily drive our children around everywhere, and yet we get worried about vaccines, whereas if you think about safety and safety risks, it's actually driving in cars and car accidents are huge. And so I think it's risk perception that is often very tricky. So if you say to somebody, you've got a 1 in a million risk, as a parent you'll go, but what if that million, 1 in a million with my child? So I think it's hard for us to visually understand risk perception. And of course in science, we can never say that anything's safe. I mean, getting out of bed in the morning is not safe. And yet if you stay in bed, you're likely to get a leg clot and die of that as well. So living is not safe, but it's trying to perceptualize and understand how we communicate safety risks. So I really like that photograph of these guys eating their lunch in what I would consider a somewhat unsafe environment, and clearly it doesn't seem to bother them too much. And I think the final thing about our myth is that, interestingly, one of the issues is because we vaccinate with needles, and I often wonder if vaccination would be much more acceptable if we moved away from needles. And it's interesting that the oral polio vaccine has always been very well accepted. And yet that is a vaccine that in very rare cases can mutate back to wild polio and actually cause polio, which is why New Zealand moved away from that to the inactivated polio vaccine. And yet the anti-immunisation lobby was never concerned about it. And I wonder how much the perception of needles actually affects all of this as well. Now, I just want to finish up, because we're nearly out of time, with just talking about then how do we communicate all this and how do we all wrap it all up. And I think there are different needs for different people. And the main thing is to really hear what somebody's concerns are and how we can respond to that. So this is some of the New Zealand research. If you look at the slide marked typologies, different people have different concerns and different awarenesses. So the people that we call the nurturers are those that do not perceive that the disease is a high risk. They may have had no experience with pertussis or measles. They may not be aware of what these diseases are really like. And so these people do not believe their children need the vaccine because they don't understand the diseases. That would be a different conversation from the parents who here we've called the fearful. And these are ones that I'm sure many of us have done this. You take your kid along to be vaccinated and it's really horrible. There's a large needle going in your kid's leg or your kid's arm and you just feel awful that you've hurt your healthy baby. And so I think the strategies for reinforcing parents that you've done a fantastic job, it's really hard to watch your baby get a needle, congratulations, is very different from parents who just don't believe pertussis is a real illness. The third group there are the vulnerables. These are the people that I talked about before that are often from very poor backgrounds and really struggle to get along to the doctors to be vaccinated. They might have a lot more pressing, urgent issues in their lives, and vaccinations way down there. These ones often need outreach strategies to go and find their children. The ones we've called unwell are often people who put off the vaccination because they're unwell or their children are unwell, and yet we know that we can vaccinate when we're unwell. You obviously don't want to vaccinate somebody when they're extremely unwell, when they've got high fever and they feel cruddy. But essentially, if you've got a runny nose like many children have, or you've got a bit of asthma, a bit of eczema, you're slightly unwell, you can still vaccinate. But if we put it off, particularly for little children, you often end up never getting around to vaccinating them at all. And then finally, the group of rejectors who feel like they've read all the science and they're really convinced and they don't want to know. Now, any community can carry a small group of rejectors within them. New Zealand population, our current data, it's looking like it's about 2% of the population. We can carry those people. The rest of us will protect them through vaccinating our children. Now, that may make some people a little angry, but so long as it's a very small group of people, we can tolerate that. And I think it's always healthy to have a little bit of healthy discussion around vaccination. So long as your rejectors are a small group of the population, and I think we tend to find that with a well-educated population who understands science, that group of people is pretty small. So moving on to my final slide, talking about how we communicate this. I mean, I will often get in my general practice something like, I do not believe in vaccines. Now, my general thought for a slide like that is I don't know what that means. You know, is this a person that's thought about the whole issue or do they have a particular fear? So often I'd take a very open approach and say, are there any specific concerns around vaccines that you wish to discuss? And I remember a couple of years ago I had an example of a mother who said that to me. And I said, is there any specific concern? And she said, well, vaccines are grown on aborted fetuses. And I went, well, actually, this is the origin of vaccines. This was the origin of the first rubella vaccine that was made back in the 1960s. They've been grown in cell culture lines ever since. They aren't made on aborted fetuses. Talked through all the issues. Within 5 minutes, she was happy to fully vaccinate both her children. So sometimes, if you can get down to the specific issue that bothers someone, you can do something about it. Now, often, they'll ask an issue you don't know anything about. So know where to go for resources. We have 0800 phone lines. We have websites. We have ways of finding out information when we don't know it. I think the second issue is if they're still sure that they don't believe in vaccines, I think it's appropriate to raise a bit of dissonance. Do you have any concerns about any of the diseases? Are you aware that your child needs to show an immunisation certificate when they start school? I think particularly in occupational health, I think the thing that worries me the most is that healthcare providers who choose not to have the flu vaccine and are unaware that asymptomatically or an early symptomatic, they can spread their disease to very vulnerable patients. And I think I find it unethical that healthcare providers choose to refuse flu vaccine and then choose to work with the most highly vulnerable populations. And anybody, particularly working in pediatrics or oncology or high-risk adult medical wards who choose not to have a flu vaccine really need to look in the mirror and wonder what they're doing. I think nowadays we have to think a lot harder about us as healthcare providers and the pertussis-based vaccines. We should not be passing pertussis on to our people either. So I think there are real ethical issues here for us as healthcare providers around what vaccines we ourselves accept and why we're not accepting them. Flu vaccination may not be perfect, but at least it's the best thing we can do to stop spreading flu to others. I don't mind if you choose to have flu yourself, but I would mind if you choose to spread it to an oncology patient or a high-risk elderly. That is not their choice, particularly when they themselves do not always respond very well to the flu vaccine. We as a community have responsibility to protect people because often individual protection is not enough. So I finish up there and I just show the slide of this history of a child back in the old iron lung days when polio was very rampant. And just we do need to remember the diseases We do need to remember that vaccinations are not perfect, but we have a huge amount of data on their safety profiles. We need them both for individual protection, but also let's remember the community protection. I think in occupational health, we've got a very long way to go in looking at the ethics of what we're doing and why we aren't more aggressively saying to ourselves, are we really trying to protect the people we're in contact with? Now, I'm going to finish there. I think the hour's pretty well up, and I thank you all for coping and putting up with it. And thanks very much to everybody.
Thank you very much, Nikki. I think you've given us a huge amount to think about there, and I know a lot of that, particularly for those of us here in New Zealand and with the current pertussis problem going on. I mean, I know that we've locally run out a pertussis campaign for many of our staff dealing with the very young and vulnerable, and it'll be very interesting, I think, for us to see what that take-up is, in, particularly in light of your comments about healthcare staff and some of their fears about vaccination, which we do see every year as well in relation to the flu vax. And I think your comments about needle phobia might be particularly relevant for that group as well, just from things I hear every day when I talk to staff. So so I think lots of food for thought there. I particularly liked your photograph of the polio queue and your comments in relation to how people, the general public, forget how severe the diseases are. But when it's fresh in people's minds, of course, prevention suddenly is the option. And I know that when I worked in the UK with the MMR scare, talking to worried parents then, one of the options that lots of parents at that time went for was a single vaccine option being paid for privately. Was that something we saw here in New Zealand at that time or not?
Yes, we did. We did see it here. And the problem with a single vaccine option is that then, of course, people are at risk of rubella and mumps and they come back later and they're not covered. And there was absolutely zero science behind why we would give people a single vaccination. As I talked briefly about the immunology, there is no basis to why we'd split the vaccine. So New Zealand decided not to make it available on the public schedule because it would just confuse people. And actually that issue has mostly died away now and we get less and less people asking for the single vaccine option. So I think that was the right call, really.
Yes, I agree with you. And in fact, it wasn't made publicly available in the UK either, but lots of parents were opting to pay for it privately, so it's a huge cost to them as a family, which is itself a worry, really.
I think we came out of science and said, we're not going to be shy here. Our science is compelling. You do not need a single dose. And we got there. Very hard on parents, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is. Your comments in relation to pertussis vaccine and pregnant women was also very interesting. I know that the US guidelines currently do advocate that. Is that something that you foresee being funded here in New Zealand for pregnant women? Or something that we should currently be advising?
We certainly should be advising it for pregnant women. It's not currently funded. There's a whole lot of things not currently funded in New Zealand, but we should be advising it. I think it's the getting over the fear that, you know, these vaccines are safe in pregnancy. They're not live vaccines. You can use them in pregnancy, flu and pertussis. And it'll protect both the mother and the newborn baby. And I think this is a relatively new strategy that people need to get their heads around. And, particularly the flu data is very compelling, and the pertussis now, you know, it's a safe vaccine. You know, you want to protect your baby.
Yeah. No, I think there's a really good message there, and I do hope that there's some midwives listening to today's lecture that will take that forward, which is great. So thank you very much once again for your lecture today. I really appreciate your contribution to the South Pacific Weather Training Teleclass Program. It's been good, and I know that I'll be listening to this again just to pick up what I may have missed the first time. So thank you. And to those listening in, thank you very much for tapping into today's lecture. If you do have any questions for Nikki, then please feel free to email them to me. My email address is on your slides, and I'll certainly make sure that I pass them on to Nikki. Our next South Pacific teleclass takes place on April the 18th when we hear from Professor Mary Louise McClaws from New South Wales about central line-associated infection in ICU. But, of course, between now and then, there are also many other lectures that you could listen into via registration on the webertraining.com website. So thank you very much to all of you for joining us today, and I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you.